Good morning, world diners and travelers. Good morning, Peter.
Oh, good morning. Here we are back again at onthemenuradio.com. We're pleased that you're joining us today. We hope that you're a regular, and if not a regular, that you'll quickly become one, because we think we're having a lot of fun here, and everybody who joins On the Menu seems to, and we've got some event-related things today and some really good information stuff today.
Yeah, well, we start out by drinking.
There we go. Well, that's always a good way to start.
And then...
Especially since in the morning, we should definitely think about that.
Yeah, and then we cook.
We do. Okay.
And then we eat desserts.
Okay. Well, it sounds like a hell of a program. Now, first up is an interview with people who are staging for the second time in a row the Pittsburgh Whiskey Festival. For those of you who are not in the Pittsburgh area, eat your hearts out.
The inaugural Pittsburgh Whiskey Festival will have a place in Peter's heart practically forever, because it turns out that a year ago it was his 65th birthday, and he spent it with somewhere between 850 and 1,000 of his closest friends at Heinz Field, and it was a very interesting event at that time. The organizers said, we're going to do this again, it's going to become an annual event like the Wine Festival, and sure enough, it's November 2008, and here we are getting ready for the second version of the Pittsburgh Whiskey Festival. And on the line with us today, we have two gentlemen who are very involved in the event: Dale Markham, who manages the event, and Max Miller, who's sort of like a spiritual, note the pun there, Max, advisor, to make sure that you have the opportunity to have a wonderful time with the beverages that are on display.
And we have Samantha.
And we have Samantha Sosniak, who actually arranged this get-together, who's involved in marketing of the event. And, of course, we have Miss Anne.
Hello.
Sitting here wondering when she's going to get a word in edgewise.
No, it's okay. You know more about booze than I do.
I do. There's a compliment. Now, Dale, you work on the Wine Festival as well, but the Whiskey Festival. Whose idea was it, first of all?
Well, the Whiskey Festival actually grew out of the mind of Edward Harrell, who at the time was with he was the CEO at the Tribune Review, and he always wanted to bring wine to the city of Pittsburgh in a larger spectrum. He'd been attending a lot of festivals, say Napa and in New York and Florida, and he figured that the city was big enough and knowledgeable enough to support such an event. So about 6-7 years ago, he decided to bring the Wine Festival together with the Trib. They did that for 2 years. The Tribune Review was the sponsor. And when Ed retired, he decided to take the festival with him.
Now, fast forward to the Whiskey Festival, because this is kind of a different thing.
Right. The Wine Festival is what I'm initially talking about. We did that for some years past. The Whiskey Festival is a fairly recent development. But about 4 years ago, I got a call from Ed. Said, hey, I need some help with this. I'm taking the Wine Festival myself, and I'm going to need a manager, and I'm going to need somebody to help me promote it and design some material with it. And that's how I was roped into the game.
And Max was involved with you with the first festival, too?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, and Max, so you answer. Why a whiskey festival, for heaven's sake?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, the Wine Festival had been so successful over the years that I think there was a growing need in the city to really explore the role that spirits have played, too. You mentioned yourself last year's festival being so enjoyable, and one of the things we tried to highlight last year was just how integrated whiskey was into the Pennsylvania and Western Pennsylvania culture. And when you start to really explore the role of spirits, you know, in our history and in our lifestyle, it's sort of a natural to try to bring that element into a social event here in Pittsburgh.
Now, there's a whole lot more complexity and a whole lot more range of product now than there used to be, and it seems like there's a new spirit almost every day.
Can I backtrack? Why is this an essential part of Pennsylvania history?
Because of the Whiskey Rebellion, the famous Whiskey Rebellion.
Right.
My goodness,
I forgot about Rebellion.
You forgot. How can you ever forget?
It turns out also, I might add, that this was, if you look at Fayette and Westmoreland County, sort of that area in that section of the city, it was really one of the largest rye whiskey producing areas in all of the United States at one point.
And rye is the spirit that's all sort of almost disappeared, right?
It's making a comeback, to your point, about new spirits coming back every day. There's a couple of very fine rye whiskeys that are coming back that don't have the same edge to them, taste-wise, that the old ones might have. It really coming back as a part of the cocktail culture.
Now, I remember last year, one of the things I enjoyed the most was, if you like, a vertical tasting of different American whiskeys. You remember that one undoubtedly from last year. Are you going to have the same kind of thing this year?
Yeah, well, we're expecting, well over 100 different types of brands there. I would say a good 60% of those will be whiskeys. And I believe you're referring to, at some of the tables, they have variations on the different whiskeys that they're offering.
Exactly. They said, well, and I said, you have several here. Which one should I start with? And just like we started with wine, we started with the youngest first. We finished up with the oldest and most special last. And it was just a wonderful time. I forget who the supplier was, but they did a great job.
Well, indeed. I mean, especially when you're if it was a Scotch table, many times the suppliers will take you through a tasting that takes you to the different regions of Scotland. And each of those scotches certainly do have a different flavor profile. Much like you say, you would go through a wine flight. You might start with a lighter lowland scotch, work your way up into the highlands, and then back over to the islands like Isla or Orkney that have much more bolder flavor. So that experience will certainly be there again this year.
Now, that's great. Now, it's interesting. Last year it was called the Whiskey Festival, but there were other spirits there, lots and lots of vodkas and gins as well. And the same is going to happen this year too?
Yeah, actually we're expanding. And one of the reasons we're trying to call it the Whiskey and Fine Spirits Festival is to really address that exact point, which is that we are really trying to expand exposure to the various spirits categories that are out there. Certainly there'll be plenty of whiskeys to enjoy, but there will also be some very fine vodkas, which of course is, you know, one of the largest categories, but certainly one of those categories that people have fallen into the myth of believing that all vodka is odorless and tasteless, when in fact they do actually have different flavors driven by, you know, the ingredients that are used to make them, whether it's a wheat or a barley materials or potatoes or grapes. You have all sorts of different vodkas, so that we'll certainly explore that this year. There'll be a few rums, a couple of brandies, certainly some tequila. So while whiskey is still at the forefront, we're certainly trying to expose folks to a lot of different opportunities and cocktails.
And what about this cocktail competition?
So we're real excited about that this year because, of course, the cocktail is making a comeback, but we've got about 7 or 8 different bars in from various parts of town that are creating their own cocktails using specific spirits that are going to be participating.
Do you have those listed at all? On your website or anything? What bartenders?
The notion of having a cocktail competition is certainly mentioned. We have not listed yet all of the bars that will be presenting different cocktails. But we suspect within, you know, the 2 weeks coming up to the festival is when we'll start to build some buzz around that.
Great. Well, if you'll be sure to let us know. Listeners, of course, you know that we'll bring that information to you through the news page and on the menu. But in any case, there are easy ways to find out more about the festival, and Dale, perhaps you fill us in there.
You can. The best way to find out about it is by going to PittsburghWhiskeyFestival.com, and we have all of our up-to-date information there. You can also purchase tickets from that same link. And the other way to do it is call us. It's 412-281-2681, and we can fill you in on the phone.
And let's recap. The location is Heinz Field. And it's one end, not the other, right?
That's correct. It's going to be on the East Club Lounge. That is the city side. So we have a great view of the city.
So will entrance be on that end this year as well? Will you get in at that end as well?
That's correct.
Last year, it seemed to me, my recollection was the people queued at both ends.
I think people were thinking of the wine festival, which happens on both sides of the...
Oh, okay. Maybe that was my mistake.
Wandered from one side to the other.
So people will enter somewhere near Gate B, and... Now, approximate cost is?
The ticket itself is $85 in advance, and it can be purchased at the door for $95.
Great. And the date, of course. We almost forgot the date, for heaven's sake.
You don't want to forget the date. The date is November 14th. That is a Friday night thing.
There you go.
So it's 6 p.m. to 9.
And there's also going to be more food, I think, than there was last year, so it's going to be a pretty complete evening.
You need food.
And bring a designated driver or take a taxi.
Would probably be
advisable.
Different elements to the festival this year. Last year was more based on experiencing the drinks themselves and the various whiskeys. This year we've added a little more to it. We've added some elements of fashion and some jewelry as well as the food. And we've added some interactive things to keep the people occupied.
Yeah, I didn't understand that, this interactive lounges.
Go ahead and explain that one, somebody.
Sure, I'll take that one. This is one of the things that we're hoping that the festival evolves into is much more, being much more interactive because of the reason you may have alluded to this, Peter, about the notion of people really not understanding kind of the importance of spirits. When people think about wine, there's this automatic association with, you know, elegance and lifestyle and things, and we would like to bring that spirits category, sort of belay some of the myths about, you know, being abusive about spirits, but really enjoying spirits in the context of your lifestyle.
Yeah, I can just see you after a vertical single malt scotch tasting trying to do the Grand Prix racing.
So in that regard, really, we're trying to just create a more of a festival environment that integrates the spirits into it, that gives people other things to do in the course of the evening, that makes it an overall experience as opposed to particularly, you know, just going table by table.
Well, I can give you an unsolicited testimonial because I went, as I mentioned last year, and even though Miss Anne wasn't there to hold my hand, which is usually what makes for a complete evening, I did.
Aren't you sweet?
I did have a wonderful time.
You went with Eric Grieve. I hope he didn't hold your hand.
I experienced some spirits of various kinds. I concentrated mostly on bourbon, which is a spiritus area I know probably least about, and I really enjoyed that. I thought it was a wonderful time, and I can heartily recommend it to anyone who has an interest in this space. And if only one of you does, it looks like the other better half will have some other things to do as well.
Yes, indeed. Yes, and I'm glad you raised that because one of the other myths is sort of, you know, you think whiskey and you think that this is just going to be a sort of a men's night out. The category has that myth surrounding it. And because we're integrating cocktails and jewels and the body cocktails, Porsche cars, Auto Palace will be providing the Porsche cars there as well. There'll be something there that crosses some of that gender divide. And makes it a much more holistic type of eating.
Except for a good party.
Yeah, good party, good time. Head for Heinz Field on November 14th. Don't forget the website is www.pittsburghwhiskeyfestival.com. And tell me, does it have an E or not?
It does have an E.
Does have an E. So it's spelt the American way, not the Scottish way.
Not the European spelling.
Pittsburgh Whiskey with an E, festival.com. Listeners, we'll hope to see you there. We'll, of course, see these fine gentlemen there. And thank you so much, Dale and Max, for joining us, and to Samantha for making sure that we were able to get this information out on the menu listeners.
Thank you for inviting us to your show, Peter and Ann. Thanks for having
thank
us.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, that's one segment down. Now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu Radio with Ann and Peter Haig. Where are we, Rabbit?
We're trying to record this segment, and we seem to be having some trouble with it. But usually at this point,
email
we say,
time.
Yeah, email time.
Our email is onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com, and we'd love to hear from you.
And the blog we're trying to get off the ground is onthemenuradio.blogspot.com. So please join and make that a new part of the On the Menu adventure as well. And now we're going to one of our really favorite people. I mean, we have a variety of favorite people who specialize in different aspects of the food and wine business, and Scott B., it seems to us, knows more than most people about the evolution of the modern American cocktail.
The evolution.
Well, it's very, very evolving, and also the inventing of and all that kind of stuff, and a great effort for several years culminating in a just-produced book. And that's what we're talking to him about.
I'm not sure if I fell in love with Scott Beatty or his drinks. Or maybe I fell in love with Scott Beatty after his drinks. Anyhow, hello, Scott. Welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we were so impressed with your whole approach to cocktails and the cocktail culture, and you represent a really big chunk of its success and development of late. But now, this book that you just put out is a knock your socks off book called Artisanal cocktails.
Now, we knew it, because we knew it was coming, because when you were still at Cyrus and you fixed a couple of really special things for us, you said you were working on a book, so we'd just been waiting for it to come out, and here it is. And what was it like? It was quite an adventure, I think you said.
Yeah, it was a lot more work than I thought it was going to be. You know, I mean, working full-time at Cyrus and also writing a book for 2 years was a bit much, but, you know, I enjoyed it.
Well,
I enjoyed it. It was definitely a lot of work, though. I mean, perfecting recipes is a very, like, tedious process, because you realize that once it's printed, that's going to kind of be the rule. That's what people are going to read. That's what they're going to do at home. That's what other bartenders that work at other restaurants, when they get the book, that's the sort of measurements that they're going to follow. So I freaked out about those quite a bit. But, you know, just to make absolutely sure that, ounce of this, half ounce of this, to make sure it was absolutely right.
Yeah, you're big on measuring.
I'm very big on measuring.
You emphasize that in this book. And that's because you're also very big on balance.
Did you also have to get a new liver after all the testing?
I'm on my third now, so the fifth one's free.
Scott, jump backwards. Let's define where we are right now with this cocktail culture.
Well, I think for a long time, cocktail part of the restaurant experience, if you want to call it that, was kind of neglected. You know, a long time ago, before Prohibition, you know, being a bartender, it was considered an art. It was a craft. You spent years being an apprentice, like learning how to make, you know, a huge repertoire of really perfect drinks consistently. Once, you know, Prohibition kicked in, I think people were more concerned with getting something that worked than something that was delicious. And once Prohibition ended, I think that trend kind of stuck, with a few exceptions, you know. It really wasn't until the 1980s with people like Dale DeGroff, you know, who sort of invented the word mixology, really to just distinguish what he was doing with his bartenders at the Rainbow Room in New York from what, you know, bartenders were expected to be doing at that time. And then it kind of took off from there. And, I mean, now you can't open up a high-profile restaurant in this country without having some kind of a stellar cocktail program.
Right. But yours is stellar in a way that stellar is sort of the wrong word to use, because in many respects you were breaking new ground.
Well, none of it would have happened without living here. You know, I mean, Northern Sonoma County is just produce paradise. They grow just about everything that you can think of here. I mean, we have two farmers markets a week in Healdsburg. There's a couple stores in town which are, you know, operated by particular farms in this area, like Love Farms, you know. Their citrus trees do really, really well in this part of the country because it doesn't freeze that intensely over here. So even in the winter, when the farmers markets are closed, there's this huge abundance of wonderful citrus to work with, which makes for great drinks. You know,
and
get things like Rangpur limes and Buddha's hand citrons, you know, everything you can think of. It's great.
And the general idea is that the contemporary cocktails in your part of the world are inspired by the seasons and the local produce. And you actually have farmers growing things to your specification.
Yeah, chefs. I mean, chefs have been doing it here for quite a long time, going all the way back. Thomas Keller, Alice Waters, people like that. I think what happened with me was I signed on to work at Cyrus, which, you know, was set to be this really exceptional restaurant. But before it opens up, it's all talk. You know, you don't really know. You know, Nick Payton was going to orchestrate the service. Douglas Keene was going to do this incredible food. And I was listening to everybody, but it wasn't until, you know, place actually opened up when I got a sense of how great it truly was.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of looked at the cocktail program that I had and saw it as kind of average by comparison to everything else going on at the restaurant. So I spent about 6 months a year just kind of really losing sleep over it and spending a lot of time going to farms, you know, trying to look at old recipes, you know, really kind of freaking out, trying to produce something that was worthy of Cyrus Restaurant. And that's kind of how this came about. And in the, you know, that process is sort of accounted for in this book. That was what this book was the result of, was me was trying to source out really interesting, unusual ingredients and make amazing drinks out of them.
Yeah, and you do. And
excuse me.
The book has been described as lush. And a lot of that goes for the
you
composition.
You could take that a number of different ways.
I would take no offense.
No, I understand completely. But I mean, I know that you're on to new adventures, and we can talk about this in just a second. But I'll bet there were quite a lot of people who came to eat at Cyrus who never got further than the bar.
No, I don't know about that. I mean, I think another reason why I felt so much pressure. And I mean, I should also say that Nick and Doug never sat me down and said that what I was doing wasn't really worthy of the restaurant. It was me kind of feeling that way. And part of that was realizing that people that were going to come into the restaurant and have this incredible multi-course experience, the very first thing that they might get, that they might opt for, would be something that I made, which isn't even on the menu, really. You know, it might be on the cocktail menu, might be suggested by the waiter, but that first sip is their first experience with the restaurant, you know? And I really wanted it to be incredible.
Well, you must have had an incredible learning curve, because you've taken all these techniques from the kitchen and moved them into the bar. I mean, you're dehydrating fruit, you're making your own sours, you're doing all this stuff from scratch, like the finest chef. In fact, I think the bar chef, right?
That's a completely accurate term.
Right.
I mean, another thing that was challenging over the years when I was kind of experimenting with creating new cocktails at other restaurants besides Cyrus, especially early on in my early 20s, you know, when we were trying to do new drinks, like sometimes you do need kitchen equipment, and you'd have chefs that would, like, chase you out of the kitchen with a knife, you know, that a fork.
They like doing that, and I noticed. They do that with restaurant critics, too.
Yeah, exactly. I won't get into that one. But, you know, Cyrus was the first kitchen where they were really completely open to me coming in and using anything I wanted to use, as long as it wasn't at some unreasonable time of the day, like 4 o'clock when they're about to open up the restaurant. But if I could get in there in the morning or early afternoon and the piece of equipment wasn't being used, I had full license to do whatever I wanted, and they encouraged me to do it. And that was very, very...
Now, you said before we came on the air that you saw the book as being not just for professional bartenders, although clearly your fellow members of your profession would perhaps be the ones who would be most interested in the adventures that you outline in the book, with the different directions that people can go in. But you said that it's also the kind of thing that you think that people hosting guests in their own home should consider, and I think a lot of people don't think about that. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, I think if you're willing to spend hours, a number of hours, kind of creating a very special meal in your home for your family or for your friends or for a party, you know, I think that it really doesn't take, I mean, if you just need to devote a little bit more time to making great drinks than to what you've been doing in the past with cocktails. You know, most of these recipes, you know, can be done within like a half hour or an hour. And that would involve kind of like sourcing out some good ingredients, squeezing fresh juice, you know, making sure you bought the right kind of liquor, and executing these things correctly in the right size glass, which is pretty important. But if you can get that down, it's really not that hard. And the more you do it, the quicker you get at it. I mean, it's amazing, you know, and the result is really something incredible. And I think the people that are coming over to your house will notice it right off.
Or they could call you, because you are also a
cocktail caterer. I was coming up to that too, but it's interesting. What do you think about this hesitation that people might have in saying, when people come to my house, I'm going to say, this is what you're going to drink before dinner? So instead of sort of filling the liquor cabinet and then asking people what they'd like to drink, instead of that, you're saying, here's what I fixed you for to drink.
Treat it like an appetizer, because that's kind of what it is.
Right.
You know what I mean? You're going to, with any appetizer, you're going to buy ingredients, you're going to cook it, and you're going to serve it on a little, you know, little plate and pass it around or whatnot. This is just like preparing another appetizer, only there's alcohol.
Yeah, but if you're at all uncertain, if you want to make sure it's done right, then of course if you're in California, Scott Peet is available, and there are Scott Peets around the country who are also available to do what it is you're now doing.
Yeah. No, I mean, cocktail catering. I mean, one of the tricky things is the laws surrounding it. I mean, I don't have a liquor license. I'm not going to buy a liquor license. I definitely can't afford one. Although, if we sell enough copies of this book, it might be possible. But you don't really need one. I mean, when I go into, I can really only do this right now in the San Francisco Bay Area, because I bring in everything, all the glassware, all the ingredients, all of it. But it does involve me going to a liquor store and picking up liquor. But if I were to do this, you know, at your house, for example, what you would do is you would call in to the liquor store and charge everything that I've set aside on your credit. So you own, uh-huh. And I just simply go pick it up, bring it to your house, and then assemble everything. And when I leave all the rest of the liquor there. And, you know, you can expect me to certainly abide by basic, you know, bartending laws. I'm not serving underage people. I'm not going to serve somebody who's visibly intoxicated. If I think somebody's getting in a car, I'm going to chase them out the door and get you and everybody else to stop them from doing it.
Yeah.
Of course I'm going to do those things, but when it comes down to the actual liquor, that's your liquor. You bought it, and it stays with you.
Okay, so that's a concept that can be made to work just about anywhere.
Just about anywhere. Yeah, you just need to, you know, you have a contract beforehand, and you explain that you are not liable for anything there, and then you know, explain to people how you operate and how it's going to go. Like, don't have your teenage daughter and her friends trying to sneak drinks from you. You know, it's not going to let that happen, you know. So yeah. It's kind of like running a little bar, but you're not really liable for it. You know, and usually this is done in, you know, in conjunction with a caterer. So I'll come in and do drinks in the beginning. Like, you might pick out two, maybe three cocktails that I'll do for your party. And then I basically pack and go. The caterer kind of takes over and serves the full meal. They might have selected some wines. You know, that whole thing proceeds, and I kind of take off. You know, and so far, I mean, I do 2, 3, 4 of these a month. They're usually with friends, so there hasn't been any problems at all. And people really seem to be enjoying it because it's those drinks that they remembered from Cyrus, like right in their home.
And is that the kind of service that is springing up across the country, or you think is likely to spring up across the country?
I know a couple people that have done it in New York and in San Francisco, and it's been a little bit problematic, I think, because they sort of, like, offered their services to the public in a very public way and ended up, you know, having some rather difficult folks there. They were also, especially in New York, I love classic cocktails, but I think a lot of what was being offered on the menu was classic cocktails, and certain people who might have been fans of those drinks, like, were having, you know, their friends come over who just don't have a palate for maraschino liqueur and green chartreuse and gin, for even gin or rye whiskey, you know, and so they were offering those things and people just weren't enjoying them.
Yeah.
So it's very important when I do these things to sit down with the host and say, okay, what do you want? They point out what they want, and if I think that anything is a little too crazy, then,
your cocktails seem totally sane compared to some of the ones in New York, like Evan Freeman stuff.
No, what are those like?
Well, I mean, like, when he has, like, the solids, I mean, he doesn't drink it, they're little cubes on a tray.
Oh, like molecular kind of mixology?
Yeah, that kind of stuff, the molecular mixology stuff.
Well, that's because of the time that he spent with Wiley Dufresne at WD-50. He's somewhere else now, isn't he? Isn't he with Sam Mason now?
Taylor.
So he moved on. He moved on to another place. But this has got to be the hardest thing to do, Scott. But you're still the best person to do it. Is to explain a little bit about the concept of maybe two or three of your different cocktail styles, because we have the advantage that we've been to Cyrus, we sat with you, we talked about what was behind it, we've now looked at the book, we have the book. Listeners, you just have to get it. What's it called? It's called Artisanal Cocktails.
Yes. Yep.
And the only way you'll really be able to appreciate what we've been talking about is if you have a copy in hand. But let's assume for a moment that we have a listener who's in Australia, or a listener who's in Greece, or a listener who's in Russia, or a listener who's in Slobovia somewhere, and they're trying to picture what we're talking about here, a cocktail that has, you know, recently living herbs, spices, leaves, fruits in them.
Here's like Fran Song.
Well,
can you take a couple of examples of your favorites and then just talk through for listeners just exactly what's in it?
Well, let's see. Most of the drinks, not all of them, will go in a Collins glass, like a tall, skinny Collins glass, or they'll go in a up glass.
Okay, an up glass being
like
kind
a
of
shaped martini glass.
Got it.
Not oversized, though. I mean, some the size of martini glasses have gotten to like a crazy
bathtubs.
Yeah, I mean, really, like 16, 20 ounce martini glasses. You got to be kidding me.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's quality, not quantity. So if we were talking about the drinks that are going in a Collins glass, and you want to talk about the Fran Song cocktail, this is kind of like me obsessing on licorice fennel type ingredient. So base of the drink is a gin made in Santa Cruz, which is flavored primarily with juniper berries, as almost all as all gins have to be. And then there's a number of like interesting botanicals in there also. There's a little bit of herb saint, which is a pastis made in New Orleans, which is like all pastis, very like kind of anise fennel driven. There's a little bit of green chartreuse, which has about 140 different ingredients in it, you know, all kinds of botanicals and herbs and roots and barks and all kinds of things. So that's sort of your base kind of licorice-y flavor that's in there. Then to get the acid into the cocktail, we're going to add, you know, a healthy dose of fresh lemon juice, a little bit of simple syrup. That, when you're making the drink, it's just going to be in an empty mixing glass. So you basically stir that up. Now we're going to add some wonderful little edible parts, which are going to cling to the ice in the glass and make it look visually very interesting. So we're going to take pickled fennel, which you can make yourself. The recipe's in the book. You're going to take a chiffonade of an herb called anise hyssop, which if you talk to a farmer, you know, if you go to the farmer's market on a regular basis and you're interested in getting this, I've seen it at a number of them, but if you don't have it and you really want to, you know, play around with it, speak to them, you know, in the fall and say, you know, next year would you be up for planting some anise hyssop in the spring and growing it for me, and they'll do it. You could also use mint as a substitute if you wanted to. But
we have hyssop in our backyard. Would it be the same
exactly,
kind?
Yeah. So you're going to have that in there, and that's cut into sort of like a chiffonade, which is like a little stringy kind of way of cutting things. You're going to throw that in the glass and then add ice, and a very particular amount of ice, just regular ice that you might get at the store. You don't want to use stuff that's in your freezer because a lot of times it picks up off flavors, meat, and other things that might be in there. So you want to, like, if you're going to do great drinks, you should really get ice from a store. It costs $2, and it makes much better cocktails.
But aren't you supposed to get special water for making your ice?
That was a different thing that I did with some distilleries in Kentucky. But that was just local water from Kentucky that I used to serve with some bourbon. But anyhow, you take all those ingredients, add this ice, shake it a couple of times, dump it into the tall Collins glass, and then if you take like a bar spoon, you can kind of like pick all the little parts out so that they're evenly distributed throughout the glass, and it looks really amazing. And then I added some different flowers in there too, pink dianthus flowers, blue borage flowers, and you can sort of add those on top. And then to sort of, you know, really showcase the fact that this is a licorice fennel drink, you take a fennel frond, like a small one, and just stick it in the center of the drink so that the frond is kind of coming out of the top of the cocktail.
Okay, listen, you got that one?
It's very easy to get. I mean, the same fennel that you were pickling, it'll have little fronds on top of it. You can do it. Where I live, the stuff grows wild all over the place.
I have it all over my garden.
I can just picture the global listeners that we talked about writing all that down.
Well, just buy the book. You want to
have that's it.
The answer is we should all buy this book so that Scott will then be encouraged to write another one.
No, it's, I mean, a lot of it, you don't need to follow these recipes. A lot of it is just kind of showing people that, you know, it teaches like really interesting techniques and introduces like interesting ingredients, and there's like so much room for experimentation on your own. You know, it's about kind of loving the process. The other drinks that are in here, the ones that are in martini glasses, you know, it's the same kind of thing. You'll add the ingredients in the base of a glass, you'll stir it, add ice there, shake it really hard, strain it out in the martini glass, but then there's some other little touches you can do to drinks that are in glasses like this, such as making interesting sugar, salt, and spice rim. You can also make foams, which kind of delves into the molecular mixology realm. All those little interesting dehydrated pieces of fruit and edible flowers and things like that, those can all be set on top of the foam. You can even, like, shake an egg white into these cocktails so that this nice little head develops on top of the drink that is also to be used as a platform for putting edible things on there. Yeah, it's really, again, it's a whole new world, but, you know, you can experiment on your own.
Well, and aside from getting the book now, do you have a website or anything, Scott?
I do, scottbeattycocktails.com.
Okay, that's...
My last name is Beattie.
Okay. Scott Beattie Cocktails.
Well, listen, we're so delighted to catch up with you again and to be able to celebrate the completion of this really sensational project that we heard about must be almost 2 years ago now.
Yeah, it was over, yeah.
Time flies when you're having fun.
And I was definitely having
fun. And I'm sure you'll keep on doing it. Scott,
yeah.
thank you so much for joining us. Yeah. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Scott.
Ciao.
And now it's time to take a break. Call it a pause for the cause. We just hope you'll stay with us and join us on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and we're going to take a little change up here. Moving from liquor's quicker, to coffee, as in gourmet rubs and other fine products.
In other words, coffee not to drink, coffee for a different purpose, although I think the people from Kuka Lake Roasters also still ship the coffee product, but the most unusual thing is what they found out about what you can do with coffee as a rub for food, which we've been experimenting with using their product, and we were delighted to welcome them to the show and find out about how they got in this business and why it all works and all that kind of stuff.
Now we're going to be talking to someone who actually has found more ways of showcasing coffee and enhancing the gourmet experience with coffee. Suzanne, tell us a little bit about your company.
Well, Anne, thank you for having me here today, and we started about 5 years ago as Kuka Lake Coffee Roasters. my partner Brian and I left the Boston area. We moved to the Finger Lakes region of New York.
Now, your name is Suzanne Atkinson. Suzanne spelled like Susan. And it's Brian Frigulietti.
Frigulietti.
Okay. So the real Italian pronunciation.
Yes, and he is a real Italian.
Oh, he is Italian, okay. So he should understand coffee very well.
You got to watch out for those fake Italians.
He's 100%.
Now, you were already in the coffee business, so you just moved where you were doing coffee?
Well, Brian was in the coffee industry.
Okay.
He was working for a relatively large company outside of Boston, and he had had his own business previously. I had always wanted a small business, and so we decided we could make this work. And initially, our plan was to come to the wine region, an area that's just amazingly beautiful here.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say you're living in probably one of the most beautiful areas of the country.
Yes,
the Finger Lakes.
Spectacular views out our window all day long, and I think that's helped to inspire and lend to our creativity with our, cooking with coffee. But we did start initially just with coffee, as we all know it, gourmet brewed coffees, and we were selling those to the wineries and doing well. And then in August of 2004, we were invited by one of the wineries, Fox Run, to participate in a garlic festival, because they used our coffee in their cafe, and we did. But the question we kept getting there was, how does coffee relate to garlic?
Well, I was just going to ask you that question.
And
how does it?
We were there because, of our affiliation with the winery and them using our coffee. But it got us thinking, and I'm originally from California. I grew up there and spent, the first 37 years of my life there. And I had traveled around the San Francisco area and had a coffee-rubbed steak many years ago.
Uh-huh.
And I started thinking about that and doing a little bit of research about coffee rubs for meat. And that's kind of the seed that started it all. Brian and I are both, we love to cook. We're not formally trained chefs, but we have good palates, and we do a lot of dinner parties, and we started experimenting with friends using some of the dry rubs we had developed, and people loved them and said, we think you should sell these.
Oh,
these are, better than the coffee element, because there's something new that no one else was doing.
Well, we were just telling you that we just used your Sicilian citrus rub last night on chicken, and it's wonderful. I just had another bite.
Thank you very much.
We were talking before we went on the air about the fact that coffee, as used in your rubs, is different than coffee that's roasted in a cup. How is that? How are they different?
Well, the coffee actually is the same. We roast the bean as we would for brewing it in your coffee maker, and then we grind it finer, more of an espresso grind, when we use it in the dry rubs. But the difference with coffee when you're using it in cooking in our dry rubs and our sauces and marinades and all the other products we've created is that coffee, when you put it with the savory, the salty, the herbs, the spices, you don't taste the coffee per se.
Okay,
so this is something that kind of confuses people initially. A lot of people see our rubs, see the sauces, and make the assumption everything's going to taste like coffee, when in fact, coffee's a natural flavor enhancer.
So it's really...
Oh, isn't that interesting?
What you're saying is that it takes a secondary role, even though it's in... I mean, it is in there. And,
right, and it is the primary thing that is building this additional layer of flavor. It's pulling out nutty and smoky characteristics. In the dry rub format, the natural oils that are in the coffee itself actually help to caramelize the surface quickly when you grill and broil, which is a nice feature. And the thing of it being a flavor enhancer, MSG, which we don't use in any of our products. Our products are all natural, but that is obviously a flavor enhancer as well, but clearly not preferred by most people.
So you were fooling around with this to begin with, and then you turned it commercial. How did some of the flavor profiles that you offer develop?
Well, initially, we started with the rub for beef, lamb, and steak, as you see most of the time. If people have ever come across a coffee rub, traditionally that's where they see it, is on red meat. And once that was so delicious, we started expanding out, saying, why can't we do it on other kinds of meats, or fish, or grilled vegetables? So we had an original line of rubs that were kind of focused on pork and poultry, or red meat, or vegetables, or seafood and whatnot. After that, it kind of led into this idea, well, why just specific to a type of meat? Why not international cooking styles? We love food from all over the world. So that's when we developed the Sicilian citrus and the mole and the jerk.
Oh, I'm following you now. So you said you started out saying these are meat-specific, but now they're a spice combination-specific kind of thing, and you get to choose.
Right, and then those are a little more versatile, and actually the originals are versatile as well. There are a lot of uses for the rubs beyond what the label might say. And now we've just come out with a cocktail collection.
Oh, tell us about that. What's that about?
Yeah, that's very exciting and going over very well. We took the... This kind of started as a little bit of fun, but they're delicious. we took the flavor profiles of cocktails, the Bloody Mary, so that has some tomato along with the coffee, tomato powder, horseradish, the celery, seed, things like that. We have a mojito with the mint and lime.
And what do you do with these things?
A margarita. You use them on meats, and they're in particular the mojito and the margarita with the lemon and lime base with the coffee are just fantastic on poultry, fish, and
scallops.
Oh, that was
scallops.
I thinking that you would mix it with gin or vodka.
No. However, one thing we have done is we've rimmed the glass for a Bloody Mary cocktail with the rub and a little kosher salt. That's been interesting. But no, they're all for cooking with, and they just kind of mimic that profile of flavors. And subsequent to the rubs coming out, we started looking at some sauces and marinades. I had actually a family recipe for a teriyaki sauce that we refigured with coffee. It's actually about half coffee, brewed coffee. So the marinades and sauces have not just the ground component, but we actually brew the coffee and then, you know, add in all the other ingredients and bottle it that way.
Well, this is a huge operation, isn't it?
Well, there's a lot of products, but we're not a huge company. We're a pretty, we're a specialty food small-scale processor, but we think it has a lot of potential, and we're really excited about the recognition we've been getting. We went to the Fancy Food Show for the first time.
Oh, I was going to ask you for that. Yeah, tell us, you won a Sophie.
We did. First time out, we were quite excited. I'm so proud of my trophy. I carry it everywhere we go to showcase our business. And that was for the Sicilian Citrus Java Rub that you had last night and enjoyed. And so we, you know, that was very exciting, Gore. So that got us some more attention.
Now, what did you do before you got into this business? It sounds like you made a major career shift here.
Oh, I did. I was actually a teacher for 22 years. Little people, kindergarten and second grade. And
you must be a saint.
and the wonderful thing about coffee-based spice rubs is they don't talk back.
Correct. It's a little bit different scenario. But I think the same thing, the elements I really enjoy about having my own business and us creating these things that no one else has thought of before with using coffee is that it lets us use that creativity. And I enjoyed that about teaching. So I think that's where the connection is for me.
There's a lot more to this story because Brian and Suzanne are involved in all kinds of community activities in the Finger Lakes region, but I think people can find out more about that for themselves at your website. So in conclusion, Suzanne, why don't you just spell out where people can go to get additional information about Kuka Coffee Roasters?
All right. Well, you can find us. We do have a website. You can reach us, probably the easiest website for listeners would be gourmet.com. And we also have a toll-free number, which is 1-888. And then it's Great Brew. And if you're from California and you've seen the license plates, that would be GR8. For great, and then
B-R-E-W. Oh, that's wonderful. Well, it seems like you're having a lot of fun, and I think that...
Oh, last thing we forgot, too. Do you have a store finder for how people can get your products at retail?
Yes, we do sell online, so any of our products can be ordered online and shipped right to your door, and we do wonderful gift baskets and all those kinds of things.
Now, that would be fun.
Coming up.
Yes, I think a gift basket would be wonderful to send for a holiday. That would be great, and great hostess presents.
Right, and actually we have a lot of people, wedding gifts and all those kinds of things as well. But we also have retail locations on our website as well, and we are starting to sell our Java Gourmet products in particular all over the United States, here and there, and hopefully more and more.
Well, we're pleased we found you. Our chicken last night loved you, and I got lots of brownie points from Anne. She said, "This is really terrific. What did you do?" And I said, "It's my little secret." Suzanne, thank you so much, and please give our best to Brian, too.
Very good. Thank you.
And stay in touch with your new ideas.
I certainly will.
Okay,
thanks,
Suzanne.
Again.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And it's time again to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and we're moving right along. We had such good guests today.
We have another great one to finish up.
Cindy Mouche, who we'll let her tell us about this wonderful book.
Cindy Mouche is, first of all, she's so extraordinarily talented. I'm sitting here looking at this gorgeous book that she just produced.
We're guessing she must be extraordinarily talented, although she wouldn't have done this book.
Oh, this book. First of all, it's huge. Cindy, welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you very much.
I can't imagine anything that you left out. It's so thorough.
Thank you.
The Art and Soul of Baking. And you got both of those in there. It's not only techniques and the recipes. You have this beautifully done. The photographs are extraordinary, not only of the finished works, but also of the techniques of you doing certain things. Is that you, your hands, I see?
I wish my hands were that beautiful.
Okay.
So we have stand-in hands,
huh?
Stand-in hands. Hands double.
Exactly.
So, and the testimonials cover probably every major baker and bakery cookbook author round, and they're raving about it. I mean, when you have Dory Greenspan and Emily Luchetti and Peter Reinhardt, Sherry Yard, I mean, raving about this book, that has to make you feel wonderful.
It does. It really is great to have other professionals appreciate the work that you put into something.
Yeah, and they all say they're using the book.
Yes, which thrills me, because, of course, I use their books as well, so
right.
That's very exciting.
Now, how did you get to start on this venture?
Well, I had been working with Sir La Todd, just teaching in their schools for a while, and they were interested in starting a cookbook publishing program for their stores, and they were looking for someone to write a big how-to-bake book, and they approached me about it, and of course I was thrilled at the opportunity and intimidated beyond belief, and it was a very good experience, not just working with them, because it's such a wonderful store, and the equipment and ingredients that they carry are top-notch, but also to put down everything in print that I have been teaching over the years. I've taught for about 20 years now.
See, that's important because this comes through in this book. It's not just recipes, listeners. It's actually, it is a how-to bake. And you also include sections on things that can be done ahead, tips from the pros. You explore all the ingredients, you explore all the techniques. It's just absolutely amazing.
Thank you. Thank you. My goal was to sort of demystify baking. I think to many people it's very intimidating, and I understand that intimidation because I do remember when I started out how frustrated I was that I didn't really understand what I was doing, and when things inevitably went wrong, I really didn't know why. And there was not a book I could turn to that had that information in language that I could understand as a home baker. And I wanted to do something that was a resource like the one I needed when I started baking. And so I may have gone even beyond what was necessary, but I do explain in very friendly language sort of the food science and how things work with each different type of pastry in the book. So that if you've never made that type of pastry before, you can feel very confident the first time you do a recipe that you know where you're going with it and you know how to make it work.
Yeah, you do it so easily, too, the way you work that into the text.
Now, were you a chef first, or were you truly a home baker, like you just said?
Well, I started off baking at home, and then I did go to culinary school, and I was a pastry chef, and still do some pastry chef work for about 20 years and was teaching baking at the same time. So I have done both for quite a while now, and I love the pastry chef work. It's very exciting it's almost like show business, you know. You're getting everything ready, and the time is coming, the doors are opening, and so there's that excitement and immediate gratification of people.
Now, where have you done that?
And liking it. I think it's been about 20 years now since I've been baking professionally.
Oh, wow. And now, I mean, you start bread, which is, of course, close to my heart. There's nothing better than fresh homemade bread, I don't think.
Especially this time of year, yes.
Yeah, and I mean, you have extensive explanations of every single thing, including the flours. Like, I was totally taken aback by your description of what they use to bleach flour, and they never use bleach flour again.
Yes, I think that's something that people need to know, and I'm hoping that this book provides the sort of information that you might not get other places, or at least culls all that information and brings it together in one location where you can look it up. But yes, when companies bleach flour, they do add things to it that you may not want to put in your body.
That's for sure.
Unbleached flour is really the best way to go for all your baking.
In fact, you sure wouldn't want to buy bleached flour from China. You don't know what might be in it.
Yeah, and you give a lot of variations on traditional things. Like I'm looking at the classic baklava with pistachios and cardamom, and then you do variations on it, like with hazelnut spice and honey.
Yes.
Oh, does that sound good or what?
I love baklava. Desserts of the Eastern Mediterranean are one of my specialties, and baklava has so many wonderful possibilities. I think that people don't realize how good it is when they get sort of the grocery store variety. And when you make it at home, it's really fairly easy, and it's just so much better than anything you can buy. It's really satisfying.
And I have a Greek friend who's made me baklava for years. I have no sweet tooth. And except the one sweet is probably the sweetest thing in the whole world that I adore is baklava. I don't know why you don't need a whole lot of it.
No, small portions are just right for baklava.
Yeah, and the test of any baking book, I'm going to try your pavlova. Because pavlova, when we lived in Australia, my pavlova was fine. And in Pittsburgh, it was impossible.
And we think it must have something to do with the eggs, but we're just not sure.
I think it has to do with humidity.
I think humidity is probably your problem.
Yeah. So it's the same recipe. And in fact, we had recipe devisor's wife actually was visiting and tried to make it. And I don't know how many we had to throw out.
Oh, no.
And we had to do a lot of jiggling with them. With a wooden spoon handle in the oven door, too.
If there's any humidity, you want to keep the oven door closed as much as possible so the humidity that's in the natural air in your kitchen won't get into the oven.
Huh. Now, I want to aside, I once made baklava, pavlova, and one of the guests at this luncheon said it was the first time she had to use a knife and fork to cut her dessert. It was a little embarrassing.
It got really gooey.
It's terrible.
Super gooey.
Well, the vice president of the publishing company for this book is from Australia, and so she made sure that I knew I should put a pavlova in the book.
Aha. Uh-huh.
It got her seal of approval, so I think you'll enjoy it.
Well, I'm going to try it, and I must say, when I say this is complete, I mean, it's the kind of thing you're going to use not only for inspiration, but for reference. And it goes all the way to, here we are, sugaring flowers, making edible flowers. And you list those, too. That's kind of important.
I would rather have people have all the information than just enough to make a mistake. So, and sugared flowers are such a beautiful finish to almost any dessert and so easy. I mean, not everyone can get out a pastry bag and pipe a beautiful finish on a cake, but certainly everyone can get some flowers and sprinkle a little sugar over them,
uh-huh.
And it looks so beautiful and so professional that it's a nice technique for the home cook to have.
You've decorating with gold or silver leaf, gold petals, and luster dust. I mean, this is, and spun sugar. I wouldn't tempt that, except at knife point.
Well, then I hope you never attempt it.
No. So what else would you like to say about this book, Cindy? It was a major accomplishment.
Oh, thank you very much. I hope with the book that people can use it not just for the recipes, but as you said, for a reference, so that no matter what other baking book they pick up, they can make those recipes and feel confident about making them. My goal with the book is to really give people the confidence in how things work and how to do things so that they feel confident in the kitchen. It's my goal for the home baker to not only make really delicious baked goods for their friends and families, but to truly enjoy their time in the kitchen. And when you feel confident and you feel like you know what you're doing, that's when baking becomes fun. And that's what I hope people will take from the book.
And that's the other aspect of this book. You do make it sound like fun.
Oh, good. Thank you.
It's hard work as it probably is to make it sound like fun.
It is fun.
Do you want to pick a couple of other really favorite recipes that are in the book, Cindy?
Well, right now, it's fall, and one of my favorite recipes in the book for this time of year is the gingerbread shortcake.
Oh, yeah, it's a gingerbread time.
Very simple scone that has all the flavors of gingerbread, a little molasses in it as well, so it's got that lovely gingerbread texture and flavor, and then that's the fruit that goes inside is caramelized apples that you just saute in a pan, and then the cream inside is an apple cider sabayon.
Oh, wow.
Which is a Calvados-based and apple juice-based sabayon. But, of course, you could do a little bit of whipped cream, and it would be fabulous. So that's one of my favorites. And another one that I love is just a really simple dessert, apple and cranberry crisp with an oatmeal crumble topping. I think when it's cold outside and you want to snuggle up in front of the fire, and just have a really warm night. I can't think of anything better than those fragrances in the kitchen. And it takes just a few minutes to put together. And so it's easy and accessible and really, really delicious.
And that's like Aunt Jeannie's crumble. Our son Adam was nuts for crumbles. I think it was probably the only thing Aunt Jeannie could make.
desserts are a very English thing anyway. Cindy, as you possibly you don't know.
Nobody cares about the main course.
No, people would like to start with dessert and really have seconds of dessert before bothering with anything else.
Those are my kind of people.
Yes.
I have a feeling that this book might cross the pond at some point.
Oh, no, I'm keeping this.
Oh, you're keeping this. You're keeping this one as a doorstop.
Oh, you know, yeah. Now, probably somebody there would adore this book. But we're going to hang on to this one.
Oh, we are? Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And I'm waiting for next summer. Tried this, caught my eye. Cindy, the lattice top nectarine blackberry pie. What could be better?
Oh, so beautiful.
Oh, that's gorgeous. Great. So, and cheers again to your accomplishment in making the book, and also to your photographer, and for the Sir La Table's good taste, and good luck with this book. It's fun talking to you.
thank you so much. It was a pleasure to see you.
Yeah, just a quick reminder, the book is called The Art and Soul of Baking, and the author is Cindy
Mouchet.
M-U-S-H-E-T. And obviously you can get it at Tulatal, but you don't have to go that far, because all you have to do is go to onthemenuradio.com, go to the OTM bookshelf, and do a search for The Art and Soul of Baking, or for Cindy, or for her last name, and it will pop up, and you can get it on your way, and you'll have a great addition to your cookbook collection.
And if I could just say one more thing.
Absolutely.
If people are interested in reading more about baking, I'm actually writing a blog right now for Sur La Table on their website.
Oh, good.
So at surlatable.com, if you go to the baking book, there'll be a link to the baking blog that's going on right now.
Oh, good.
That's great.
Well, how's it coming?
Great. Yeah, there's been a good response to it. It's been up for about 6 weeks now.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
great. Well, we have a new blog that just started, so I'll put a cross-reference over to your blog on our blog. And,
great.
It's just getting out of hand.
Oh, no. That's what blogging is all about. Uh-huh. Most people actually don't know that blogging is short for something.
Which is?
It's short for weblogging.
Weblogging.
So they took the we off, and it just became blogging. And I guess everybody's doing it, so even the old farts that on the menu radio decided we better get with it.
Well, I'll enjoy reading that.
Cindy.
Okay, Cindy, thank you.
Thank you again.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's hard to believe time's flown so fast, and another hour is complete of On the Menu Radio. We're delighted that you joined us, and we'll hope to talk to you again same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.